Anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
get trapped in that. Scrolling through documentation for my rowing machine silently. We're supposed to be recording this podcast. Well.
Hello, and welcome to Codex. It's a casual lore podcast. My name is Phil.
And I'm Logan.
And today's episode is about... Well... I haven't told you what this is, right?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't know what we're doing.
I alluded in a previous recording that perhaps we were doing Twisted Metal or Turok. Just had T's on the brain. So instead, today we are talking about Lara Croft Tomb Raider.
I love how we are completely incapable of planning anything and following through.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, a flight of fancy catches me, and now we're talking about Tomb Raider instead of Dinosaur Hunters. I guess a different Dinosaur Hunter.
I almost think anytime we're like, all right, we're going to do this topic next, that needs to go on a list of things we never do.
Yeah, yeah. Ugh, yes, we that's probably a smart idea. And then someday we'll come back and do it. That'll be like the end of show roundup, like the last season that we do is just all the shit we said we were going to do and then just never did.
The podcast bucket list.
Yeah. Before we get into Lara Croft Tomb Raider, do you have a bright spot to share with us today?
You'd think I would have. Oh, yeah. I'm going to make it about RuneScape since we're not talking about that today.
Perfect.
They released the official old school RuneScape channel, released a metal cover album, and it is excellent.
Like of all the OSRS songs and stuff,
yeah,
some good ones
they
in there.
Pay, they find like YouTube creators who do things around RuneScape, and then they just hire them to do things officially for them. Has been kind of their MO lately.
That's nuts.
So there was a lo-fi album that is excellent. I got through like two semesters with that thing playing. And then, yeah, the metal one just came out, and it rips. I don't know who made that one. That one might have actually been the OSRS team. I haven't looked. Or just the Jagex audio team, actually. Because some of the RS3 tracks have some more fully voiced instrumentation, and it sounds kind of similar. But it is everything I want out of a metal cover album.
Especially, like, the fantasy vibes of RuneScape also probably just make for good subject matter.
Yeah. And then they paid some pixel art individual to, like, render scenes for all of the songs.
Like his music videos? Either
kind of like you're kind of like you're getting a gameplay video of the area in question where that song would play.
Okay. So some real machinima.
Yeah, it's done in 2D pixel art instead of whatever the old school polygon count is.
Oh, man. Okay.
It's done super well. I'll just send it to you.
Yeah, I will have to check this out. I'll also drop the link in the show notes because this sounds important for people to experience.
It's good for, like, lifting. You'll have to let us know if it's any good for running, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I will give that a go. Always need that. Something to put before or after BFG Division and Rip and Tear.
The only downside is it's currently a 41-minute video with the tracks time-stamped, but not on separate separate tracks themselves.
I'll just rip that and separate them out.
I haven't done it yet, but that's been my plan. There
Amazing.
You go.
Amazing. I will
There's
watch
the metal
this.
Mixtape.
The metal mixtape. Oh, that's so good.
It's real good. Like, even just scrubbing through it, like, the visuals are done really well. Autumn Voyage starts at, like, around 5:30. That's one of my go-to tracks.
All right.
And it's from Lumbridge, from a very nostalgic area. So that's a good place to start.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, I will listen to
what
that.
What about you?
Mine is... Oh, you know what? Yesterday, I began the progress on building that outdoor sofa I alluded to in probably a recording a month and a half ago. It was 90 degrees outside and too much humidity, and I sat there absolutely drenched in sweat building a small outdoor sofa for our patio that at this rate will be done by August, I think.
Just in time to pack it in.
Yep. I mean, if we have a winter like we had last year, it'll be usable year round.
Yeah, there is that also. Yeah.
But it was fun. I haven't like gone out and built anything out of wood and saws and screws in a while, so it was good to get out there and do that again.
How are you finishing the wood? Is this a stain situation? A paint?
It's a stain situation, and then some basically a deck sealer on top of it since it's outdoor. So it's pressure treated, yeah, and then color it in some way because it's still kind of raw lumbery and green, and then like a deck sealer or something to hopefully let it last a little bit longer. It's all made out of little square balusters is what they're called, like basically the verticals in a railing or something. So it makes it a little bit easier.
2x2s.
Yeah. So it makes it easier to just like pop pieces out. If as the thing ages, I can kind of like swap out components and everything instead of having to rebuild the entire damn thing, which is the problem with our current patio set. So it is somewhat future-proofed. We'll see if it ends up staying that way, but currently it is being built. I have roughly a seat built and a side armrest, but it is not usable quite yet.
This would be a giant pain in the rear and require far more planning than it's worth. But it would be kind of neat to see one, build two, leave one out and let it get like kind of weather-beaten, and then mix those parts together to reconstruct both of them with half of each.
Just a ship of Theseus outdoor set?
Yeah, exactly. Is it still the same sofa? Who knows?
Whom's could say?
One Laura Croft, perhaps?
Yeah, so the Laura Croft episode is a built-in 2 to 3 discrete segments I have. I texted you before this that I have too many notes. I think this might be the episode that I have done that has the most amount of notes, probably besides the first one where I just went too hard. But
I mean, it's a big franchise, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it's huge.
Half a dozen games or more, 3 or 4 movies, like
comic books, novels, a Netflix animated series. Yeah, it's way bigger than I thought it was, and it has a bit more of a history and kind of like there's more lore behind Lara Croft and like the games in general that I hadn't really thought about. But before we kind of get into the history of the games and stuff, have you played any Tomb Raider games before?
Yes. I played one of the more polygonal looking ones on PC for an afternoon or two.
Okay.
20 years ago, probably.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah. Like one of the early PC titles. But I think that is it. I definitely haven't touched any of the newer ones, like the Crystal Dynamics or whoever's making those. Okay. I haven't worked with any of those at all.
Interesting. Okay. So if you were to, we're jumping a little bit ahead already, but if you were to like distill the essence of Lara Croft down, like what would you say, like what comes to mind first when you think about Lara Croft?
I mean, I've seen more of the movies than I've played of the games. I don't have a lot of familiarity with the IP itself. My memory is that it was like basically what if Indiana Jones was a booth babe, which is not ideal.
Yep.
So hopefully there's a little more meat on the bone than that.
Okay.
But that is my like early to mid 2000s memory of Lara Croft.
Awesome. Okay. So the general history and just kind of based on our purview here for the show, I'm mostly going to stick to the games. I'll mention some of the other stuff as we go, but for the most part, just assume we're talking about the games. The Angelina Jolie movie exists and the Alicia Vikander movie exists and all of that stuff, but I had to stop somewhere. So it's mostly the games. So Tomb Raider, it's a long-running game series. It started in 96 by a development team called Core Design. They did multiple games. I think it was like 5 or 6 in total, and it ended in Tomb Raider Angel of Darkness, which was the last of theirs and was basically like they pushed development to get it done in time for the second Angelina Jolie movie in 2003. And it kind of didn't do well because it was a buggy nightmare and they pushed the development. So it just didn't work out. So that is that original run of games by Core Design is referred to as the original timeline. So that's probably one of the ones that you played was like Tomb Raider 1 or Tomb Raider 2 or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because it would have been like N64 PS1 generation.
When yeah.
I touched one, I think.
Okay. So then after that, so the Angel of Darkness game was received pretty poorly, and they moved the development to Crystal Dynamics, like you mentioned. And the series then was rebooted by the team behind Legacy of Kain, which I didn't know, but that is just a fun little... The Legacy of Kain continues to have a legacy. And they made Tomb Raider Legend, and that is referred to as the Legend timeline. There's, I think, one or two other games after that. But that's like the first reboot once it moved away from Core Design. One of the main creators who we'll talk about a little bit later, Toby Gard is his name. He was a consultant with Crystal Dynamics for the Legend group. So he worked at Core Design, developed the character, left for reasons we'll get into, came back to Crystal Dynamics as a consultant and kind of like helped them build the character from there. So that's
okay. So there's some like history that ties across the two timelines essentially.
Yeah.
From a development side.
Yeah. And for the most part, it was all published by Eidos. So the publisher at least carried through from most of these, I think.
Okay. So they probably had some amount of access to like reproduction materials and
yeah.
stuff like that to work off of between the two.
Yeah. So the next part of the timeline here, in 2013, Crystal Dynamics rebooted the series again, and they created what's called the Survivor timeline now. So the Legend timeline was kind of like a soft reboot of Tomb Raider 1, like what they had going on there. But the Survivor timeline like changed tons of stuff. So this is the stuff that came out in 2013. It's its own trilogy.
Okay.
It changes Lara's appearance. She has pants now. They changed some of her backstory, and this is the like gritty reboot of Lara Croft. Like it, and it like takes away what the development team at some point was referring to as like her Teflon coating. Like the whole point is that like she gets scratched and she gets bloodied and she's in like true peril and then has to get out of it.
So more street level, less of a superhero like character.
Right. So yeah, those are the general three that we'll touch on. But also, yes, like the Angelina Jolie movies are there. There's a bunch of other like side games that came out. I think there's like a Game Boy Advance one. Like it is a huge property. And just kind of since you alluded to it and I wrote it down, you mentioned that you played a very like polygonal version of Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, when I was doing some research on this, the Wikipedia page has actual polygon counts for a lot of them, because in the next section here, we'll talk about it a bit more, but Lara Croft is like a very fluid character. The whole thing is that she's like a PS1 era heroine. I think she was even on like the Dreamcast and stuff. and it was supposed to be more fluid, kind of lifelike movement instead of something like a Banjo-Kazooie or like a Super Mario 64. So they tried to like make her appear more realistic as they go. So Tomb Raider 1, she was made up of 230 polygons. Tomb Raider 3, she had 300. And then the end of the core design trilogy. So the Tomb Raider 1 was 1996. Angel of Darkness in 2003 had 4,400 polygons.
Okay.
And then we get into Tomb Raider Legend, which was the next one by Crystal Dynamics, and that is 9,800 polygons. And then Underworld, which is the final game of that reboot section, she now has 32,000 polygons.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it like goes up a lot. The kind of weird part about this, and I don't know, there's a lot you can read into discourse about Lara Croft, and we will talk about it a little bit, but a lot of the descriptions in Wikipedia very much are like, ah, yes, we wanted to make her curvier, and we needed to make her like more natural walking and everything, and that's why the polygon updates were happening, and as like it went along with hardware, like that was a focus of the team. So you go from the incredibly hilarious now, and I think probably canonical image of her of like completely like triangle chested to now she is like moving on to like, you know, more curvy. They're making her more realistic. So Tomb Raider Underworld is also interesting because it's the first Tomb Raider game to have motion capture, which I only mention because the person who did motion capture for Lara Croft was an Olympic gold medalist and a stunt woman, and her name is Heidi Moneymaker.
That's amazing.
It's a really good name.
That's a great name.
Yeah. So
does she also play poker?
Oh, I hope so. So the kind of the next thing I wanted to talk about with Lara Croft is that like she is this cool character. I have a lot about like who she is as a character later. But the thing that I think is kind of important is recognizing that Lara Croft is this cultural icon. Like she is for at least the late 90s up there with characters like Sonic the Hedgehog and Mario, where there she is like incredibly recognizable and is unlike those other characters, maybe Sonic to a lesser degree, is like commercialized to hell. So she is in commercials for Visa. She is in commercials for energy drinks. She was in commercials for a car brand called Seat, which I think is a Spanish brand. She had custom renders made for a U2 1997 tour. And there was an entire Lara Croft tribute album that featured artists like Moby, Depeche Mode, and Faith No More. She was even... have you heard this?
What? No, I have zero memory of this.
Okay.
This feels like you're lying. I wish you were lying to me.
Yeah. It continues. So she was also, she in like the original timeline, she went to a real world boarding school in the UK somewhere, and they didn't license the school. They just like used the name of this real life place.
Love it.
And then the company was like, or the school was like, hey, that kind of sucks that you did that on account of that's money and stuff that we could be doing.
Illegal.
Yeah. It would be really cool if we could now just use Lara Croft in a commercial for freebies. And they're like, okay, I guess we kind of have to do that. Sure.
Yeah.
So they turned it around, and then there was an advertisement from a real world boarding school that said, you know, go to the school. It's the school of Lara Croft. And then maybe
that at least makes sense to some degree.
I guess
good ways, but the winding path that we took to get to the school advertisement at least tracks in my head more than any of the things you said in the previous 2 minutes.
All right, this one's my favorite then. In 2006, Lara Croft was the face of a Skin Cancer Awareness Foundation advertisement in Nevada.
Nah, I'm good. I quit the show.
Yeah.
This is like the Pokemon airline all over again. It's like, how did this? Yep. Why is this?
Yep, yep. There are toys. There are entire fashion lines. There are wallets, Zippo lighters, art exhibitions, and hiking boots that you could get Tomb Raider branding on. And
did you get any sense as to why this is happening?
She's just a really popular character. And like, it's mostly, we'll talk about it in a second, but it's primarily because she is a human female appearing person who is like becomes a sex symbol. Like, she becomes a highly marketable mascot character in a time when mascot characters are not really humanoid in that kind of way. Like, she becomes like a, you know, in the same kind of like Sonic the Hedgehog edgy kind of way, like, she's the sexy lady with the two guns, and you can, that is marketable in, you know, 96, and
yeah,
I guess like also 2008, but you know,
so only mostly bad reasons, because like, yeah. I don't remember there being like a Lara Croft is not a character to me from that era.
Yeah,
I feel like, yeah, mascot is the way I would describe it.
Yeah, like, she goes on fun adventures and stuff. But, like, even if you pull back a little bit, like, why, when so many terrible video game adaptations have happened, why did Lara Croft get, is there three Angelina Jolie movies? There's Tomb Raider.
Two.
Then there's Cradle of Life. Yeah. There might be a third one. But there's even, you know, the 2016 movie too, you know, like, somehow this, like, maybe it is just the beginnings of the, like, 1990s edgy version of Indiana Jones. Like, when also you're in a world where Indiana Jones stopped coming out early 80s, right?
Oh boy. I'm not putting a number on that. I don't remember.
Yeah. But, you know, it's...
You can read those emails.
We're pre-Crystal Skull. Like, there is this weird...
A better time, some would say.
Some would say.
The Last Crusade came out in 1989.
Okay. Yeah, so... Yeah, you're pre-Crystal Skull and 10 years post Last Crusade. Maybe it is just people, like, treasure hunting, and they were not being fed.
Damn you, Harrison Ford.
Yeah, yeah. So the hiking boots and everything are fun. It's funny that you mentioned earlier that part of what you think of when you think of Lara Croft is booth babes, because Eidos, the publisher, hired several models throughout the history of the franchise to appear at E3, trade shows, things like that. She would do press shoots. And there were so many of them that in 2008, Guinness awarded Lara Croft a record for the most real-life stand-ins of a fictional character.
Yeah, I believe all of that. Well, maybe we'll do a whole show on Guinness someday, too. But,
yeah.
And the nightmare that is that company.
Yeah.
Yeah, the booth babe vibes were strong in all of the worst ways.
Yes.
In my memory of how this character was presented.
Yeah. And it kind of got a little weird because there were some unofficial things that happened that ended up leaning into that image as well. So one of the many, many models, she was fired pretty quickly after becoming the Lara Croft model because she appeared in Playboy, and then they basically put a giant Tomb Raider on the cover that said, hey, look, we got Tomb Raider in this one. So it did not help the idea of Lara Croft as a sex symbol.
I also wonder how much the ease of cosplay factors into the popularity.
Yeah.
That is a look you can pull off without a ton of resources and still have it be pretty convincing.
Yeah, you got your short shorts, your blue tank top, and your thigh high ankle boots.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of leans in a bit to this other aspect of Lara Croft as a character, and specifically like leaning from the Playboy bit, like her as a sex symbol in the late 90s and then leading into like even into the early 2000s and maybe some would argue the late 2000s. So kind of from the beginning, like Time Magazine is out there. Like we're not talking about like video game publications, like Time Magazine is considering her like the first video game sex symbol. Probably the first thing you think of when you conjure up an image of Lara Croft are those cone shaped boobs, and perhaps to the detriment of Toby Gard and his vision. Most people just think of her as a busty, sexy character first, treasure hunter second.
I'm surprised to hear that was the first video game sex symbol in the lands of Gex and your
and Leisure Suit Larry.
Yeah,
you know, being a furry was not as mainstream for like Banjo-Kazooie mm-hmm. folks, you know, like.
The internet had not evolved far enough to take advantage of those models yet.
I mean, also we're talking about Time Magazine here, so
yeah,
of repute.
This is the first thing we're willing to talk about as a publication.
Yeah. So the thing about I mentioned him earlier, Toby Gard, he's kind of labeled as the character's creator. It's Core Design was a development team, and obviously like multiple people are involved in every decision when it comes to developing games and everything, but he's largely regarded as the creator of the character. And he ended up leaving Core Design pretty early on in the series of games. And that there's a piece from The Guardian actually that I came across in 2005. And the interviewer asked him, you left Core Design originally over concerns that Lara was getting sexed up. She still seems that way in Legend, the Crystal Dynamic one that Toby Gard was consulting on. He says, how do you feel about that? And Toby's answer, I think, is also, you know, within the context of 2005, says, it wasn't about her boobs getting bigger. She was always designed to look good. People's psychology is that they like attractive characters on both sexes. What I objected to was the marketing, which represented Lara in a way that was nothing like the character. At the time, I didn't like that, and it prompted me to want to retain control of characters I created in the future, so that's why I left. And he kind of goes on to mention that the purpose of Lara Croft and like the original concept behind that is that she shouldn't necessarily be sexy just because of how she looks, but she should be sexy because of her power and capability.
I do think I remember the like early Angelina Jolie movies at least making her wildly competent.
Yes.
Which is nice. It's also good to hear that he thought it was a character and not just a stack of polygons walking around.
Yeah.
And maybe that, like, overemphasis into marketing is why my memory of the character is so flat. Because there is, like, there's not room for character in advertisements of the time. You were just slapping, essentially, a logo onto a product.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could definitely see that they maybe just diluted that down so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. I think there's also a lot of, you know, the culture, like, it's one of those things, like, perhaps he didn't intend for Lara Croft to be only known as a sexy character, and then also you do other things. That there is also kind of, like, another story about how when one of the games came around, like, the second one or something, he accidentally, as if this is a thing that you can do in a game developed in 97, but he's on record saying that he accidentally upped the like boob size to 150%, and everyone thought that he thought it was a funny joke, and then the rest of the team was like, oh, actually, we should just do that. So, you know, it's not completely.
I was just joking. Unless.
So the whole like as a sex symbol thing got worse, obviously. Like, we are people on the internet now. So in 2008, she was named the Game Babe of the Year in PlayStation, the official magazine. She appeared in PlayStation Magazine's swimsuit issue. She has appeared in Maxim and is still to this day constantly listed as the sexiest video game character on multiple sites. There is even a very pervasive rumor after Tomb Raider 1 came out that the development team had put in a nude Lara cheat code, something that people have just continued to look for, and then ultimately you can just mod it in now. That's a thing that you can do when you want to play these games.
That has some real schoolyard vibes to it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it feels like something that was alluded to in the back of one of those Blockbuster cheat code tomes that you would get.
Yeah, yeah, it was like half width, weirdly sized cardboard paperback nightmares that were just full of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. So I bring all of that up because I think that it's really hard to talk about Lara Croft as a character without kind of talking about her as like a cultural object. And also because it's been, I mean, it's almost been 30 years since the first Tomb Raider game. So there's this combination of like gamers going to be gaming, but also she's been around long enough to where there is now actual discourse about Lara Croft as a, you know, as it pertains to feminism, objectification of, you know, female bodies and empowerment. And there's been kind of stuff that is basically saying that, like, you know, it sucks, but also it's maybe not all that bad, especially early on in the you know, late 90s, where she's hypersexualized and has an incredibly unattainable body and a lot of the same core critiques of something like the Barbie doll's gone through in the past 10, 15 years. But it has kind of paired with this thing where Lara Croft has paved the way for more female characters in games, like more female-led games, because of her popularity as this cultural icon.
Yeah, it's complicated, as you say.
Yeah.
Anytime we dip into like late 90s, mid 2000s video game culture, for lack of a better term, it's usually a rough time.
Yes.
I feel like I remember like Giant Bomb kind of talking about the reboots too, that there was still a little bit of maybe less than ideal treatment there too.
Yes.
Of the way they beat that character around.
Yeah, we will get into that. The last thing I want to kind of bring up here is that the point of, you know, a character developed for, you know, possibly letting more female characters become mainstream, as well as, you know, the publishing team at Eidos, when they were asked about it, I think in the early Tomb Raider 1 through 3 era, they alleged, and I couldn't find a source for this, so, you know, coming from the publisher behind the game and also in a forward-facing statement, take it with, you know, a whole handful of salt, but basically what they were saying is that probably 20 to 25% of the players who ended up purchasing Lara Croft were female. So it's this, you know, they're alleging that, you know, we brought more female gamers into the space with a female-led game. I don't know how much I believe that as like a net positive thing that they were able to do, but, you know, that's what they said.
I mean, ladies play video games too.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes.
That feels like a low percentage, maybe. I guess it was my gut reaction, but
yeah, Yeah. So that's,
I feel like you could use that same stat to be like, ladies didn't like how you treated this character, so they didn't buy it.
Yep. Yeah.
I would assume we have to be getting pretty close to parity. I guess I don't know what the demographics are any longer, but everybody plays games now of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not sure. The last thing I wanted to kind of bring up before we get into her as a character, though, is I was reading some more stuff kind of talking about Lara Croft as a character and like why she is so compelling and what is like, why are there people who will play these games, especially like the hyper sexualized versions of them in like Lara Croft 1, 2, and 3 before they get into the more, I guess, like survival trilogy where it's maybe less front and center in the same kind of way. And there's this psychological concept about her being such a compelling character to some male audiences because, one, they are fearful of strong, powerful women, and two, because she is a virtual character that they are controlling, the people who are controlling Lara are being chivalrous protectors of an attractive woman, which is what, you know, this one psychologist, I think his name is Oscar Holmberg, from Germany, alleges as to like perhaps something that makes her such a compelling character to some male audiences who perhaps wouldn't have been drawn to a game being led by a woman.
I wonder how that, I would be curious to see how those opinions are different between something like Tomb Raider and then maybe Perfect Dark, which also has a like competent female protagonist.
Yeah.
And came out roughly the same time.
Yeah, around the same time. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked into that. It'd be an interesting place to dig in.
Yeah, I would assume no one else has looked into it yet either, but it might be interesting to try to isolate some of that from, because no one knows who Joanna Dark is anymore, I would imagine.
Right.
Sans, I guess, prior to the most recent gameplay release of the new one, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm hard-pressed to think of other prominent franchises in the same level as Tomb Raider that have like primarily led, like female-led gameplay, and even to the like third-person perspective as well. I can't really think of any.
Yeah, yeah, that was pretty one-sided up through until like character creators started becoming more prevalent. What, like your Mass Effect 1, maybe?
Maybe.
It's kind of one of your turning points there.
And like even the other, mostly because I was going to joke, tell you that this was the episode. The really bad example of this is, do you remember that Bethesda game Wet?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I remember seeing that on a shelf at like a family video or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, even I don't remember when that came out. I think that's probably mid 2000s.
Yeah.
Like that was Xbox 360 era. So I guess probably
2009.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, we're still not out of the woods in 2009, you know, like that stuff is still coming out in like a real bad way.
Gosh, I forgot about that game.
Yeah. Huh. Yep. Yeah. All right. We got the cultural stuff out of the way. We can now talk about Lara Croft, the character. Yeah.
Mostly a nightmare. Maybe had some good downstream effects, fortunately. But
yes.
Still.
Still not great.
Still not ideal.
Yeah.
Progress has been made. We'll take a positive spin on it. How about that?
Yeah. Some progress has been made. Let's take a quick break and then we will, I will tell you about Lara Croft, the character. This feels like a good stopping point for a second. Where was I? Oh yes. We were talking about,
we were about to start the episode.
Yep. We were about to do the episode part of the episode. Mm-hmm. Lara Croft.
Yep.
Lara Croft, colon, Tomb Raider. So before she was Lara Croft, she was, well, sorry, before she was Lara Croft, she was Laura Cruz. when Tomb Raider was being developed in the early 90s, it was supposed to star a character very incredibly reminiscent of Indiana Jones, but with a mustache. He had a leather jacket, he had a fedora, and there was a satchel involved. I don't know if there was a whip or a gun.
Legally distinct Indiana.
Yeah, with literally the cartoon mustache and glasses, basically.
Groucho Marx Harrison Ford, yeah, called it a day.
Yes. And then they're like, wait a minute, that's not good. We shouldn't do that. So then the lead graphic artist, the Toby Gard guy that we've been talking about, he had five-ish other options before they kind of landed on Lara Croft as we know it. Originally was the lead male character, and then wanted to basically, again, his words, perhaps revisionist, I don't know, wanted to counter stereotypical female characters, and he said that they are characterized as, quote, bimbos or dominatrix types. So he was inspired by, I've never heard of this artist, but pop artist Nina Cherry, and comic book characters like Tank Girl, which I don't know enough about Tank Girl to have an opinion about that, but I feel like I've come across DeviantArt pages, and I don't know if I would also use that as a great barometer of strong female leads, but, you know, such as it is.
Is there a movie for that?
Oh, I don't know.
I have a vague memory of a very B-looking budgeted movie with that title.
I would believe it.
Ice-T, Malcolm McDowell, Naomi Watts are all in 1995's Tank Girl.
Interesting. Okay. Why? Why does that exist?
I think it was some like post-apocalyptic thing, and we've now reached the extent of my Tank Girl knowledge.
Yeah, great. Okay. So but part of the other designs that he came up with, there was, and these are all quotes, so just let it happen. Okay. A sociopathic blondes, muscle women, flat-topped hip-hopsters, and a Nazi-like militant in a baseball cap. Those were the other before Lara Croft was Lara Croft options.
That is definitely someone's vision board.
Yes. Yeah. So then they settled on a tough South American woman with a braided hair, which is kind of like the, I guess, like canonical depiction of Lara Croft now. And her name was Laura Cruz.
Do we know why the name change?
Yeah, so it came from Eidos, I guess, where they wanted to appeal more to like the UK audience, which is why they changed her name to Lara. And then I guess the possibly apocryphal story, but you know, who knows? The core design is based in the UK, so they changed her name to Lara, made her like a from the hometown, I guess. And they changed her origin to England, and then they wanted something that sounded like Cruz, so they went through a phone book to find a name that sounded similar, and they came across Lara Croft.
Love it.
That is the probably apocryphal story, but, you know, so it goes.
I think that's maybe dumb enough to be true.
Yeah, probably. So yes, that is why she is Lara Croft. I think we kind of touched on the reboots and timelines, but just to kind of like say it again, there are technically 8 to 10 official incarnations of Lara Croft as a character. There are 2 different movie timelines, which include, you know, the Angelina Jolie movies and then the Alicia Vikander movie that I don't think ever went anywhere, that is loosely based on one of the game timelines, but isn't. There are 2 different animation timelines, there are 2 comic book timelines, and there are 4 video game timelines. So there's the original, which is Tomb Raider 1 through 3, and then Angel of Darkness and those ones that core design made. There is the Legend timeline, which is Tomb Raider Legend, and I think Underworld, which is the original Crystal Dynamics reboot we talked about. And then there's the Survivor timeline, which is the like newer 2013 trilogy that came out. There is a fourth video game timeline, and it is called the Reloaded timeline. And this is the brand new one that Crystal Dynamics is currently working on. And we know very little about it, but it sounds like it's what if you took the previous three and put them all together. That somehow they're all canon. I don't know. Like the multiverses of Lara Croft, maybe. Who knows?
We're getting Lara Croft Endgame.
Yeah.
The next one here.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm on
so board I don't know what that is, but you know, there you have it.
So they're on their second iteration now, Crystal Dynamics?
So this is Reloaded is their third.
Their third game or their third timeline?
Their third timeline.
Okay.
They made Legends, which is, I think it's just Legend and Underworld, but then Survivor is Tomb Raider, Rise of the Tomb Raider, and Shadow of the Tomb Raider is the Survivor timeline. And then whatever this new one is.
Gotcha. I think I like the frequent reboots.
I kind of do too. It's nice to like keep it going. I have no feeling about any of the timelines particularly. So, you know, just give me a new story, I guess. If you're going to keep it alive.
My gut reaction was negative, but it seems like they're at least doing things with it. So that's kind of interesting on its own.
Yeah, yeah. And like for the most part, like there's an entire table on the wiki that talks about all of the similarities and differences. Like most of them, there's a plane crash, and in some of them, the dad dies, and sometimes the dad isn't dead. And it just goes down the list where like the origin story is generally the same, just in different orders or, you know, slightly different things. But I think the Reloaded is going to be interesting to see how they mesh it all together. But yeah, it's interesting that they keep rebooting it in that kind of way.
It's starting to feel like the Spider-Man universe here.
Yeah, that's a good pull, yeah.
Way less fractured from a rights standpoint, it seems like.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
But we are kind of bouncing around, and there's some overlap, but not necessarily a ton either.
Yeah. So generally, the incredibly high-level things that are generally considered true throughout all of those different timelines is, and this is literally the copy from the Tomb Raider Lara Croft trailer, which is an incredibly good watch. She is, 1, born into wealth. She is, 2, groomed by the elite. And 3, she is trained for combat. That is Lara Croft as a character.
That's your show bible right there.
Yes.
It's a one-pager.
Yep. She is an English archaeologist to differing degrees in all of the different incarnations. She is a treasure hunter, and she is a tomb raider. She is born into the aristocracy. She is literally Lady Croft. She mostly doesn't like the upper-class society and decides to go into the secrets of the past and find adventure and cool objects. She explicitly doesn't do the Indiana Jones thing. She does the perhaps more English thing where instead of putting it in a museum, she puts it in her manor house, which is basically a museum.
Let's be fair. It's not that different. When the museum is still named after the person anyway, then
yeah.
You're taking the thing and putting it in someone else's house.
Someone else's house, yeah. I mean, it's not crated up. You can go into her house in multiple of the games and you can see some of the cool shit she's got.
Maybe this is jumping too far ahead. How fantastical is this universe?
Ah, yes. This is the fun thing that I also continue to forget about Tomb Raider. So, very. It's incredibly fantastical at times. So the origin timeline is very fantastical. And it gets like really wild almost immediately. So she basically goes on a ton of adventures throughout those games and gets these fantastical objects in her house, which include things like the Philosopher's Stone, the Spear of Destiny, and, you guessed it, the Ark of the Covenant.
We're just doing it, huh?
Yes. Yeah. She travels the world. The first game has you fighting, I guess, spoiler alert for Tomb Raider 1. Your main antagonist is Nahtla, is her name. And she is a eugenics crazed scientist. But surprise, she's actually a recently unfrozen from an ice capsule part of the Atlantis Triumvirate, that her ice capsule was unfrozen during the Los Alamos tests in 1945. And she wants to make a bunch of scary mutants to kill all of humanity so that she can rule from New Atlantis.
Except for the eugenics. That feels like some kind of prog band's backstory.
Mm-hmm. Yes. She find pieces of Atlantis that gives her like cosmic powers. She, as you mentioned earlier about Joanna Dark, she travels to Area 51 and finds a UFO and an alien. She finds new tunnels beneath King Tut's tomb, and she even meets Bigfoot.
Man, prolific.
Yes.
Just doing it for the love of the game.
Yeah.
I feel like honestly, after you get the Spear of Destiny and the Philosopher's Stone, most people would retire. But
yeah, and in the timeline, I think Philosopher's Stone happens in like they take place in real time also. So like Tomb Raider 1 is primarily 1996, but she gets the Philosopher's Stone in 89. So like she's been sitting on that for a while and then gets into other fun stuff.
Yeah, I think I would pack it in at that point, honestly.
Yes.
Yeah. I only need one slot on the high scores. Don't need to fill the whole board.
Yeah. She has quite an adventure in the original timeline. The general origins of Lara Croft is hilariously pulled from game manuals. Amazing that is a primary source for this.
I suppose a lot of that stuff is before you got like huge marketing material dumps and collector's editions and
yeah
art books and all that stuff. So yeah, and that fat game manual was law at the time.
Yeah. I've never played Tomb Raider 1, but I mean the newest trilogy is laden with all of the modern stuff of, you know, like pictures that have notes on them and codex entries and stuff. I can't imagine that Tomb Raider 1 had a lore section in there that told you all about Laura's upbringing at her Scottish boarding school.
Yeah, probably not a ton of incidental environmental storytelling, but maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe we'll go back and look at that game.
They just put out a collection, I think, of,
I say it's got to be on GOG or something, right?
Maybe those ones. So she, in the origin timeline, she has a plane crash, like I mentioned. There's almost always a plane crash, and she is stranded in the Himalayas for 2 weeks, and she has to survive, and then realizes that, wait a minute, this cool adventure lifestyle is for me. So I'm not going to be in the aristocracy. I'm going to go get some adventures around the world. She publishes books, and she is a mercenary, big game hunter, and a master thief, which are somewhat different than the archaeology routes that I think they would like to portray.
Yeah, definitely some more moral ambiguity than a lot of the other like tentpole characters at the time.
Yeah, and I think it kind of leans a bit into where, well, it doesn't lean into it because it didn't exist yet, but it goes, you can see a lot of similarities in something like Uncharted, where Nathan Drake is also a treasure hunter and thief, and is less
rapscallion.
Yes, like less concerned with the conservation of history in that kind of way.
Yeah, your Brendan Fraser mummy comes to mind.
Yes.
Well.
Yeah, yeah. The second, just kind of like round out how some of the fantastical stuff that happens in the original setup, she fights a dragon in the second game.
Perfect.
Cause she goes to China as you would expect. And then in Angel of Darkness, the last game by Core Design, she kills a thing called a Nephilim. Do you know what a Nephilim is?
Is that a ancient giant of days gone past?
That's similar. It is a creature that is spawned from the angels and humans doing it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. There's just a lot of weird, like, I think one of the things that I find very fun and interesting about having gone through this, like, this is probably, I'm trying to think back, like, I guess, like, besides the Pokemon games or something, is, like, the oldest game that I have really looked into in this kind of way. And it's just really funny how fast and loose it is in a very, like, 1990s mummy kind of way. Like, we're not going to think about that. Like, we're not going to talk about how, like, she kills this thing that just, like, confirms the existence of angels in this world. Like, we're not going to talk about that. It's just, hey, there's a cult and they're trying to do this thing and we got to murder it.
Yeah.
And it was a simpler time, you know? I appreciate that.
I think you got to meet things where they're at. There's nothing wrong with, like, we want our big dumb set piece with just enough structure to keep it standing.
Yes, yes. So yeah, that's the origin timeline of Lara Croft. So I kind of glossed over some of the other ones, mostly because the survivor timeline is kind of the one that splits the most from what the expected portrayal of her is. It's also, these are the only Tomb Raider games I've played. So I've played through Tomb Raider and then Rise and Shadow of the Tomb Raider. I really liked them. They are very different games. They fall, like, gameplay wise into the free, like, the open zone and kind of Metroidvania style games. So you, like, get your tools, like an ice pick or a grapple rope. You get XP to get new skills. You hunt animals and gather materials like cloth to make fire arrows. You know, you go around. It plays a bit more like Uncharted, but it's grittier. Like, that is kind of what they were going for.
Is that, like... So definitely less of a power fantasy there, I'm assuming. Like, I guess, how far down that ladder do you go?
Yeah. So maybe a good way to put this in context, in the origin timeline, Lara Croft's birthday is, hilariously, Valentine's Day, 1968. So by the time you are getting to her, she is in her, like, just about turning 30, so, like, late 20s, and then by the time you get to the later games, she is, like, firmly mid-30s, almost 40s.
Okay.
In the survivor timeline, this is a bit of a gut punch, her birthday is Valentine's Day, 1992. So, technically, Lara Croft is younger than both of us.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which hurts. So, those games take place in 2013 is the first one. So she is 21. And kind of the focus of the Survivor trilogy is, this is Lara's first, like, this is her origin story. Like, the true origin story, she's, like, out on an expedition with her pals to do a documentary about this one place. Finds it, shit goes bad. She's, like, shipwrecked on an island and has to survive through that. And this kind of gets into the other stuff that you were talking about, I think, in the last segment about, I think Giant Bomb was talking about how, like, they really beat her around in kind of a rough way. These games are, all three of them, are significantly darker in tone than what I've seen of the other ones. there's like the first game has like threats of sexual violence. There's like an attempt for Lara to grapple with killing her first human person in that game. It kind of falls flat a little bit because the rest of that game is just murdering dudes left and right.
Yeah, she just immediately mow down 40 other people after having this like really traumatic experience, and just like, well, glad we checked that box.
Yeah. And kind
glad
of
glad I unpacked that. Time to keep killing dudes.
Moving on. The thing that I remember from those games, and I remember coming up in discussion, is that this was also the time of just really gruesome deaths. If you missed jumps or like fell off a cliff or something, there was always the absolute sharpest looking stick at the bottom of that jump, and they would show you getting impaled. Like it was really gruesome and gratuitous in like ways that I think they thought it was making like the stakes be very real, but in the end it was just, here's this 21-year-old woman getting absolutely destroyed by the environment around her, and like you didn't need to make this murder porn like that.
Yeah, I wonder what the, because if that only happens when you die, then like it's hard to say those events are canonical in any way, because
right,
you back up and then you replay that part, so that didn't happen. So I wonder what the goal was, I guess, with that choice.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I imagine that it was just the like failure is a binary sometimes. Like you miss that and things go wrong, and instead of just fading to black as you fall down this waterfall, we have to like show it. I'm not sure.
I wonder if it's somewhat like the Disney actor doing some incredibly adult film as soon as they get out of their contract, of just trying to draw like a really clear point of delineation between the earlier work and what they're doing now.
Yeah, like where, she's not like, doing cartwheels with her double pistols. She's trying to survive as well as possible.
Yeah, like you are kind of inverting the power dynamics of the original trilogy there.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So they do that. Most of that first game takes place on that island, in the South Pacific, I think. And the major changes from the origin timeline and the survivor one is the purpose of her father. So in the first one, he is in the origin timeline, he's a pretty well known archaeologist and like is like well read and mostly supportive of Lara until she decides to kind of go off and do this treasure hunting thing, which is why she becomes a mercenary and master thief, so that she can kind of get out from, you know, once she turns that all down, she can make some money, I guess. In the survivor timeline, her father is gone. He is deceased and was kind of removed from her life for most of it anyways. Her mother vanished during one of their fun family expeditions to do some archaeology. And then Lord Richard Croft is his name in the new trilogy. He basically goes down a really wild path of having theories about, you know, fantastical things and like attempting to find the source of the soul and like determining that the soul is real, and basically is regarded as a quack in his field, and then ends up committing suicide, and then, you know, she's left in the care of someone else. So her life changes by, instead of going to that Scottish boarding school, she now goes to the University College London. So she's a street tough Laura in this one. And then that's how she gets hooked up with the group of friends, where they're, you know, traveling the world, and then they're going to go on an expedition with a professor or a documentarian to this place called Yamatai to, you know, go see what's going on there. Do some research about stuff. And then she is shipwrecked. Bad things happen. most of her friends die. Some of them make it out. That's kind of the impetus for her to be like, I'm gonna murder these dudes and I'm gonna continue murdering them because I'm not gonna let my friends get hurt again.
Is this just Far Cry 3?
Kind of. It's like less shit heal than Far Cry 3, but yeah. Yeah.
Similar bullet points there of like stranded, things go bad, things get worse, kill everyone on the island.
Yeah. I think maybe the difference here, and it's been a while since I played Far Cry 3, but there's not cults and supernatural zombie samurais, are there?
I don't think so. We count Blood Dragon?
Oh, I'm no.
Okay, then definitely not.
Okay. Yeah, so there's cults, there's supernatural zombie samurais that are supposed to stop the people who follow the cult. It's a soul thing. Basically, she has to save her friend so that a very old emperor god thing does not have her soul transferred into her friend. Does that. That's kind of the first game. Her big deal is, you know, basically becoming the Tomb Raider. And then the second and third games are generally the same gameplay-wise. There's a couple of changes in the third one that are more important. But the beginning of the second game starts with her struggling with PTSD from her experience in the first game. And she ends up trying to deal with that by finding a source of immortality in a mythical Russian city somewhere. So, you know, she goes to Siberia to get right with herself, I guess.
We all get there in our own way.
Yeah, yeah. And the second game is primarily about her following her father's trail and, like, proving his research correct. The whole idea of the origin of the soul and that there is an... The whole point of that game is finding this thing called the Divine Source, which grants immortality. And in that game, you're introduced to the primary antagonist, I guess, of the second and third one, which is this group called Trinity, which is a religious military order and a group of fanatics that just want to, you know, control humanity.
With real mad about Vatican II still.
Yep. So yeah, they're introduced, and then you kind of, you know, it's very much the same as the first one. You go through Siberia and you mow down all of these dudes who have guns named after different places, like different stations. You know, you got your, I'm trying to remember, the Pontiff shotgun is one of them, and their helicopter pilots are called Cardinals. So, you know, it's a little on the nose, but...
I might need to go through this one. This seems like the right kind of dumb for a few afternoons.
Yeah, it's also, I would say that the second one is very much... Like, it is the Empire Strikes Back of the series. Like, they basically nail the second one in a good way.
Do you each of the three feel like a closed loop of some kind? Like, are they compelling individually?
I think the first one is pretty compelling. The second one, I think you could probably just jump in and it's fine as like its own separate adventure. The third one is, I think it is a bit bloated and I don't think that you would enjoy it by itself as much as the others. I remember walking away from the third one thinking that it was a bit long and arduous for what could have been an interesting story.
That's fair, and not unexpected, I suppose.
Yeah. Also, the second one, there's like a whole DLC where you get Scarecrow gassed and you have to fight the Baba Yaga. So, you know, they're having more fun with it in that one.
Okay. Yeah, I think two might be.
Yeah, there's a Gulag escape. I think that's kind of the fun thing about this is that they made these three games like feel grittier and like, Her like takedowns are, they are not like she doesn't know Krav Maga, right? Like she is like fighting these dudes pretty tooth and nail in some of it, and it's like rough, and it does feel desperate when you play them. But I think the second one is the one where it really shines of like her dealing with what happened in the last one, and then also still trying to keep doing her thing. And then in the third of the games, and I think it's kind of worthwhile getting into them, is that she basically it starts by her going to Cozumel, tracing down Trinity, and accidentally sets off a supernatural apocalypse in a like Mayan calendar kind of way.
Hey, we have, as we've discussed recently, time is complicated, and yes, sometimes it goes bad for you.
Yeah, it went real bad for Lara Croft at that point. So the whole adventure is her dealing with the fact that she is perhaps doomed, at least this region, to be destroyed if she doesn't solve her problems. And then also kind of her place in all three of these games, like all of her friends getting hurt, like all of her friends dying because she's trying her best, but really messing it up. And also maybe if she just wouldn't have been there, it wouldn't have been a problem. Yeah, she sets off this apocalypse. She goes to a fabled Peruvian city that is very much cribbing off of the whole idea of a native tribe in the Amazon that has not had contact with modern humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just hiding out in Peru. There's ancient monster guardians. There's a battle on top of a Mayan pyramid during an eclipse. You get possessed by the ancient gods of that area. And then there's actually a really nice, poignant moment of Lara grappling with what she's done to the world.
Does she come to a satisfying conclusion with that grappling?
Not really.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you can.
Yeah, it's complicated, I guess. Like it's interesting to look at the scope of the Survivor trilogy from the beginnings, where she is like fighting for her life, and then at one point the story turns and she is now fighting for her friends to escape and like stop this really terrible thing from happening. And then the second one is very much like dealing with the outcome of all of that and how it has changed her fundamentally as a person, and like kind of taking her tomb raiding like moniker and using it more as a coping mechanism than as like a character trait that she enjoys and wants to continue. And then the third game is very much like her realizing that, well, it's also like her leaning into it. So it's, you know, they call it the shadow of the Tomb Raider. Do you get it? It's dark. Yeah. She like the big mechanic change in that one, I think, is like mud camouflage, like full blown predator style,
yes,
mud camouflage, and fear mechanics. It's like being able to intimidate or like cause fear in characters to make them move different places. And it plays nicely thematically. Like it is nice where it's like, okay, like you have set off this really bad apocalypse, and now it is like, you got to do whatever you can to like really truly own that you are like Batman Tomb Raider to get this thing done. And she does, but there is like a good moment where I remember, I actually went back and watched the video, and it is not as I remember as memory often is, but there is this really good moment where she is like escaping from like capture, and then ends up at a, it's like an oil refinery in the area, and is like having this huge gun battle. And like, I remember going through it, and you're like killing like probably 40, 50, 60 dudes. And it just is like a slog, and you just go through it, and then you blow up a helicopter, and then the helicopter blows up the entire refinery around you. And you get up and you're met by one of your friends, and like Lara is like having a very like intense emotional moment, and like she says, I'm making everything worse. And you look around, and this entire refinery, like this part of this community that was probably the only wealth that was coming into this area of Peru, is completely destroyed, like surrounded by fire. There's 50 to 60 dead bodies all around you. And then your friend comes up and is like, okay, but like, hey, like we got to solve this riddle to stop the apocalypse. And it's this moment where it's like, man, you had it. Like you understood that like throughout this entire game, the whole point is that like she is interacting with this, and like we have to bring it back to, well, Trinity's the bad guys. Like we got to stop the bad guys. But it is like she is making everything worse. And it's nice that, like, the character is able to look back and say, like, man, like, actually I am having an impact on this world.
It sounds like they tried to write a morally gray character in a more delineated story. Or vice versa. I don't know which. It sounds like there's some dissonance there.
Yeah, and there is. Like, the thing that I always say when I try to recommend these games to people, and it's less so true for something like Uncharted, because I think that's just an action movie romp fun time, but the emotional points of this later Tomb Raider stuff really has the sense of, like, if you wanted that first game to pop really hard with this notion that, like, Lara Croft is out here, she's fighting for an entire life, I think you kill one person in that game. Like, I think that, like, and this is the fundamental problem with a lot of these, is that what I want is a puzzle-solving tomb raiding game where I am, like, helping these people succeed. I don't need, like, a religious military order of knights to deal with and, like, gun down. But the implications of, like, her friends being in danger and she kills one person and that, like, makes a mark on a person, like, unpack that. Like, let's do that. And the same with some of these other ones where, you know, that PTSD hits pretty hard if that last game you weren't, you know, the body count was in the hundreds.
Yeah, that's, I think a lot of stories, especially games, suffer from that, where the development of the story and the way that interacts with the gameplay seem at odds with each other.
Yeah.
It sounds like you were maybe hoping for, like, a more simulation style, like a Prey kind of thing, as opposed to an action adventure romp. And it kind of sounds like they weren't entirely sure which direction they were going to go with that either.
Yeah, and it's fun because the way that the games are structured is that usually you go to a zone, and in that zone, there's, like, a story moment that is happening. Like, you have an objective to do in that story mode, and then you move on to the next one. But the way that the worlds are structured is that you can kind of fast travel back to those areas and get all those collectibles and open up tombs and stuff as you get more tools. And I think the way that it worked is that you would go back to them, and those areas, instead of being, like, this really intense snow coming down, like, it is a beautiful, bright, sunny day. And that's, like, typically how you know that, like, this area is clear of mostly all the bad guys, so you can just go do all of the free roam stuff. And I just kind of wish it was that.
That's neat. Yeah. Does the game present Lara as a morally good character?
I think especially the third one, it leans a little too hard into the thing that I think is really hard to avoid with a game like this, and that is the extreme white English savior coming in to save these native peoples. And I guess technically that means that the game thinks that she is morally correct in most senses, because she's dealing with an end of the world threat, but I don't know. It feels weird as a player anyways.
Okay, so they don't unpack that angle of it.
No, I don't think so.
Which is, yeah, I guess I wouldn't expect them to. But, like, within the logic of the game universe, she is good?
Yes, generally. Okay. I think the way that it's set up is that she is good and is doing a really bad job of it, I think is the general sense.
Okay.
Because she's, I mean, even by the last one, she's not even 25, I don't think.
Yikes, okay. Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you were hoping for maybe to live in that gray area a little harder.
Yeah. Or like, go one way or the other with it, right? Like, if she's, like, covering herself in mud and is, like, terrifying all of these mercenaries, like, let's talk about that. Like, that is a character thing that is happening. Like, you don't just, that's not, like, a fun thing that you do. Like, it takes time to slather yourself in mud and like predator kill someone, and that is far more ruthless than what you're doing in the first game. Like that is a character development right there, not just a skill. And it's not really acknowledged all that much.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty dramatic temperamental shift too, from how you've described the first. And maybe that's supposed to maybe we're supposed to infer stakes from that, I suppose.
Maybe, yeah.
That she is sacrificing her personhood for the goal, but if they don't draw enough attention to that, then I could see that being less than satisfying.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, the big difference between these games and the originals is that, we're talking about open zone games that are, I think my hour count in the third one, at least, was 40 plus. These are now big games where those narrative pacing beats are, that they're doled out slowly, and by the time you've gone into the next zone, you might have forgotten how some of that stuff has played out.
Okay. It almost sounds like someone had kind of a neat movie script that they shoehorned a game into.
Kind of, yeah. And the game is fun to play, it is gameplay wise, it is a good experience and I really enjoyed it, but I think it suffers from, I in this original notes, I had it as a Ubisoft style kind of thing. And it feels that way. You either chop out, a third of this game and it feels tighter and it feels, more poignant with some of those points they're trying to hit. Or you do what they did and, you add icons on the map, you add crafting, you do all that stuff, and now you got yourself a 40 to 50 hour game that maybe could have been 25 to 30 and still feel good. But yeah, that is the Survivor timeline. It gets kind of weird because there's a whole post-credit scene after she stops the apocalypse. She's planning her next adventure somewhere, and the ending note is basically that she is acknowledging that her role in all of this isn't necessarily to solve the world's mysteries, to go to the tombs and unlock them and get all of that knowledge, especially because sometimes it means you cause an apocalypse, but it is more to protect them from people like Trinity who would like to use them for nefarious purposes.
So that kind of feels like they were trying to ramp into maybe sort of where that first set started. Of now we have established the character as the character is meant to be going forward. Are they going to pick this up at all? Because you said that they're on to a different timeline entirely now, correct?
Yeah, and they haven't said a ton about what the Reloaded timeline is. What I remember when it was released, when they kind of mentioned that it was happening, was that it was trying to mesh all of them together, that somehow they would be connected in a way. But they have shown incredibly little about what this is. I think there is one game that she is in, yes, technically in the Reloaded timeline, but it is not. Right now a TombRaider.com, which is amazing that is a website that exists. It has, we're looping all the way back to what we were talking about earlier, but it has the Survivor timeline proportioned Lara Croft, but in the Lara Croft Tomb Raider 1 outfit. So it's like, hey, we're making the next thing, and we're taking the best from both worlds, I guess. There's a whole ARG and all of that fun stuff. But yeah, it seems like it's perhaps
Lara Croft into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, maybe. Or it's just, we're rebooting the timeline again, and it is now, it is now one of the Survivor timeline style games, but the key art here is Tomb Raider featuring Lara Croft, and it is her in her booty shorts staring down a T-Rex, which I guess happens in one of the original games. So I don't know. Bringing them all together.
It seems like they've made like a neat enough foundation to do different things with.
Yeah.
So I hope they continue to tinker with those knobs and levers and try different things.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still curious about what they end up doing with the character. Because, like, ultimately, and I know we talked about her cultural impact for a while before, but, like, ultimately, she is a big, prominent character. And I am excited to see what they do with this big, prominent character. I just hope it continues to make progress towards trying to make something modern and aware of the world and what this, you know, Indiana Jones like character looks like in 2024. Cause it's, you know, it's really weird to go back to those games and think that like, that's what we're going to do now.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully we don't end up in like a Duke Nukem-esque scenario.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, this is a product unstuck from time that maybe could have stayed there.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that they will not do that. And like Crystal Dynamics is still in charge of it, last I heard, and they did make that last trilogy. So, you know, hopefully good things happen. But I think this is another project that's probably a little bit in layoff limbo for now.
I am seeing one bullet point from the 2013 Tomb Raider that you did not mention.
Okay.
That this was the first game to feature Tress Effects.
No, this was Tress Effects?
Yeah. This was the first game to get Tress Effects 1.0. I don't know why I remember that, but
I'm so disappointed in not knowing that.
For some reason Tress Effects is stuck in my head.
That's so disappointing.
That's what I'm here for. To bring the disappointment.
Oh wow. There's even side by sides of Tress Effects. That's incredible. I mean, these games still look good. Like that's kind of the other thing. They nailed the Uncharted, we put all the money on the screen feeling to it, and they look damn good. Like the environments are really cool. The movement is nice. Like it feels good. And I remember the actual like gameplay being good too. I just wish there was more grapple puzzles and less shooting dudes with arrows.
So are these still on your recommended list at this point?
Yes.
I think they're Game Pass.
Yeah.
As well?
At least the first two are Game Pass. I think the third one is too. I actually just re-downloaded them before this game or before this chat. Because I really enjoy them. They're a fun time.
Maybe I should check one of those out. I might have to throw a couple, like throw a weekend into the second one, maybe.
Yeah. It's good. I enjoy them. They are my kind of linear storytelling, but in an open space where I can kind of explore and solve puzzles.
I do see the first three are on GOG also. So maybe we'll do a weird Lara Croft thing here.
Look at
some of the old ones and play through maybe that second one.
Yeah, that would be good. I would like that. It's been a while since I played them too. Like I think I played them when they came out, but I haven't revisited them since then. So it'd be good to get a refresher on some of that stuff. All right. I think we have plumbed the depths of two timelines of Lara Croft. There's still so much more to do. But that I think that will have to wait for another episode.
We went long.
This might be the longest one.
This is definitely our longest like single topic day of recording.
Yes.
Who knows what the final cut looks like, but
we'll see the edit. But
from a pink behind the curtains standpoint, this has definitely been the longest.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean if you like this, you know, to tell a friend, rate and review us on podcast player of choice. You can hit up GordonHamburger.com. You can read reviews, links to Twitch, YouTube, all that stuff. If you do like this, if you like the digging into like the cultural aspect and like the character itself, I think we kind of did this with our last RuneScape with the or with the Grand Exchange episodes too, where we kind of talked a little bit about real world and the in-game stuff. Let us know. I actually really enjoyed digging into this. I wasn't sure how much fun, you know, digging into feminist depictions of Lara Croft was going to be, but there's actually good discussion out there about it. So yeah, let us know. Hit the contact page. You can follow me or the Gordon Hamburger site on Threads. You know, I'm at Phil Bothan. Site is at Gordon Hamburger. Logan is unavailable. But yeah, thanks for listening. And we will be next week, or we'll be back next week with potentially a shorter episode. I guess, who knows?
It could really be anything. Do you want to like pitch a topic now and then we can ignore it?
Here's a good threat. You threatened me with Thomas the Tank Engine once.
I did threaten you with Thomas the Tank Engine. So the problem with the Thomas the Tank Engine episode, which will happen because I am that brand of crazy, is it requires me to read a book. Which I think I did find a PDF of, now that I'm running back through this in my head. The Island of Sodor, Its People, History, and Railways was published by the creator and has not been reprinted since, like, the early 90s. So
amazing.
It is tough to find, but I think I found a PDF of it somewhere. But it's got maps. It is intense. It is like old school RuneScape wiki levels of intense.
I am ready for the deep lore on Sartop of that.
Yeah, we're gonna do that at some point for sure.
Amazing.
Okay. I'll start reading that book.
Yes. And
this is gonna be a multi-part thing.
We'll just trade off. You'll do Thomas the Tank Engine. I'll do McDonald's Land.